Okay, tomorrow. Okay. But we have many, many, many baskets in the wood rooms, and you want to buy your tickets to enter a chance to win. So we had something new this year. It's called OA Face to Face. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about it. Unfortunately, due to technical issues and my forgetful brain, I forgot the adapter. We're not able to show you a promo tonight. But tomorrow in the hospitality suite, what this is it's a journey to other regions to bring other OA members experience, strength, and hope on video to bring the message to you. This is only shown at the birthday party. It's not to be distributed. We are abiding by tradition 11. It's not to be shown at the level of press, radio, film, television. And it started, the idea started, we were sitting at dinner at Region 2 convention, and people were saying, they'd like to hear different people or see different people. We're used to the same crowd that come to these meetings. And the idea just started, and we started with a test, and then I traveled to different region conventions with my little flip video. It's like a 3x5 card, and was asking them in 3 minutes, what does OA mean to you? What has it done for you? What are your struggles? How do you deal with the triggers? Give your experience, strength, and hope to those who are here. So we have a running loop that will be shown in the hospitality suite from 8:30-ish till about 7 tomorrow. And if we can get things running, we'll try to show it at the meals tomorrow. So you can see a promotion of just some of the inspirational recovery and stories. I mean, it really touched my heart when you really have to sum up all your years, all your, trials and tribulations in 3 minutes. And it's really, I hope you get a chance to stop by and take a look at it. So, without further ado, we have invited this keynote speaker tonight from New York, and it is my privilege to welcome Don C.
Hi, everybody. My name is Don. I'm a compulsive eater and food addict. Happy birthday, OA. I got up this morning and I did what I always do every morning, which is say, good morning, God, thank you for the gift of another day. Help me not waste it. Grant me the discipline to be productive and useful today and the power to abstain from toxic food, toxic thinking, and toxic acting. And then I, with a bow to the big book, I go on and say, direct my thinking today, God, keep me free of self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. I've been doing that for a very, very, very long time. While it's OA's birthday tonight, next Thursday happens to be my 30th anniversary in OA, my first meeting. My first meeting, January 26th, 1982. So 30th anniversary. So I want to thank you all for throwing this very nice party for me tonight. We'll talk about self-centeredness a little bit later. So I came 30 years ago. I've never left. Something about sticking around until I get it right. Practice, practice, practice. No drill, no skill. I think some of my old teachers used to say, music teacher, I think it was. No drill, no skill. Practice, practice, practice. Holding on to it for me is a day-to-day routine of actions. Eternal vigilance, I guess. There is no graduation. There is no graduation, no matter how long that we've been around. I remember that first meeting very well. It was in room 101 of the Downtowner Motor Inn in Durham, North Carolina. 10 women and me. I had no clue what was going on. I was drunk on food, of course, and didn't even know I was drunk. They were telling stories about their eating, and they were laughing about it, and I didn't get it. After the meeting, I went up to the oldest woman in the room. She was maybe 60 or so, and I was 41, so she was old. Everything is relative, isn't it? And I asked her, I said, I don't get it. What in the world is this abstinence thing that you kept talking about, that everybody was talking about? I just don't understand what sex has to do with losing weight. She laughed, true story, she laughed hysterically, and then I heard for the very first time, but not the last, keep coming back. 30 days before that night, I had written the note, cleaned up my stuff, left my wallet and the keys in the car, and parked beside the bridge. In the middle of the night, walked to the center of the bridge over the Hudson River in New York, and climbed up on the ledge. It was a culmination of obsessing for a very long time on the most humane way to do it and leave no mess for my wife and my two kids. No messy guns, no knives, no pills, no body, no mess. I would simply be washed out to sea and become fish food. It was snowing, middle of the night, black. I could see absolutely nothing below me, many hundred feet down. Except just way off in the distance, there was a faint light of what must have been a barge coming down the river. I don't know how long I was standing there, how long I stood there. And I honestly, truly do not remember climbing down. But obviously I did, or I wouldn't be here tonight. I must have gone home and quietly climbed back into bed beside my wife, who wasn't even aware that I was gone. A couple of weeks later, in the middle of another sleepless night, she mentioned to me that she had heard of a fat farm down in North Carolina, I lived in New York at the time, that treated not just the body, but the head as well, and she says, and you really need that. And thus I ended up in that first meeting in room 101 of the Downtowner Motor Inn in Durham, North Carolina. My 20s and my 30s were really the nighttime of my life. That January night in 1982 was the beginning of a new day, although, of course, I had no clue at the time. All I wanted to do was die. I saw no reason for living. I just didn't quite have the guts to do it. How did I get there? Well, a little bit about my childhood. In one form or another, fear and insecurity had dominated my life as a small child, as early as I can remember. I've since learned that fear has a lot of stepchildren, controlling, perfectionism, procrastination, false pride, worry. I was raised in the mountains of Appalachia by a mentally challenged, uneducated, smothering mother, Christian fundamentalist, who had been abused by a gutter-level alcoholic father and raised in abject poverty. After the third time, she had her father arrested, and he put a straight razor to her throat, threatening to cut her throat and kill her if she ever did it again. She ran away from home to the big city. Got a job, lied about her age. She never went back home and she never went back to school. I think she was about 13 when she ran away. This is Appalachia. She never returned, so her education was about 6th grade. My mother's overwhelming fears and insecurities, and you can see quickly what that was all about, oozed into me as a child. Now remember, hindsight is terrific. I'm looking back after all these years and seeing what looked like was going on. And she's still alive at 92, by the way. Still the same person. And I am now the caregiver, by the way. But that's a whole other story. Those insecurities oozed into me in my childhood, as well as a lot of other self-destructive, what I know today is self-destructive and dysfunctional thinking. The good news, of course, is that fear is learned. And if fear is learned, then it can be unlearned. And it took me a very long time to know that. In OA, I learned that I can unlearn fear. The fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism of my childhood did not serve me well. I was convinced already at seven, 8 years old that I was doomed to hell because I thought bad things. And thinking was as bad as doing. At least that's what I heard in my head as I remember. I was dragged to church several times a week. And then in the summers, night after night of tent meetings and revivals, sawdust tent type, where they speak in tongues and all kinds of hysterical things go on. And I was a little child. As I got older, I began to rebel. And then sometime around maybe 12 or so, I just flat out refused to go anymore. My antagonism toward organized religion and its hypocrisy grew and grew and grew until I finally began calling myself an atheist. To me, organized religion was behind all the world's worst problems from the beginning of time. War after war was fought in the name of my God versus your God. Justifying murder and pillage in the name of God was the way I looked at organized religion. That's what it had been all about. As a kid, I always felt out of step, a little different, separate, distrustful, afraid. The world was a hostile and unfriendly place for me, where I had to do a lot of pretending and play acting in order to get along. The siege mentality that I grew up with, us versus them, dominated my whole family. I'll give you an example of this self-destructive thinking that I came out of my childhood with. I call them toxic ideas or toxic thinking today. Had to do with self-worth. From my earliest days, I can remember my mother's never-ending admonition about what will they think? What will they think? She said this every time she was trying to teach me something about how to behave. Her life and her behavior was totally based on getting others to like her, or at the very least, not dislike her. Her feelings of inferiority and her less than meant that all behavior in my house was measured by what we thought others would think of it. This resulted in me becoming a consummate actor. Acting, acting, acting. I was whatever I thought would get me strokes or at the least avoid criticism. I would be whatever I needed to be to not look stupid, bad, less than, or different. Especially not different. So we had to pretend to be just like everyone else. Underneath this was this false belief that my value, and this is what I was talking about here, my value is based upon what others think of me. Or more accurately, what I think others think of me. Which is, of course, total nonsense. My value is based upon what I think of me, not what I think others think of me. So I got to be 42 years old before I began to see this flawed thinking. At age 41, when I came to the program, I was inwardly still the same frightened child, except more so. A lot of years had passed, a lot of pretense, role-playing, acting, as I was said before, stroke-seeking, fear, doubt, and insecurity. The result of all of that was self-hatred, a feeling of uselessness, adrift, trapped, victim. All of this I felt inwardly, despite being a pretty high-functioning, educated, corporate type of exec on the outside. I had monetary things. We lived in the right places. We lived in the right houses. Our kids went to the right schools. Because I mostly followed the "this is what you're supposed to do" script my whole life. I was still trying to gain those strokes. And there's nothing that works in the corporate world any better than somebody who is totally willing to do whatever it takes, however many hours a day, to do what people want him to do. So that's how I got to perfectionism and also became a workaholic, another part of my story. This inside-outside disparity, and this is really the key point here, this inside-outside disparity continued for my first 40 years until I began to bring the two together through the transformation and rebuilding process of the 12 steps. Becoming authentic, who I really was a monumental big deal for me. Bringing the inside and outside together brought me self-respect, which I had never, ever had. You're beginning to see how I might have got to that bridge. A little about my eating history. I was not a grossly obese child, though I was always overweight. From the beginning, I was always overweight, but not grossly obese. In high school, I played sports, lettered in 3 sports. I burned up thousands of calories that I consumed every day. I was overeating, but I burned it up. The pattern of inside-outside disparity that I was talking about, the play-acting, the Jekyll and Hyde, dominated my teenage years. I was a goody-two-shoes with the teachers during the day, and I ran with the hoods at night. This was the 50s. Some of you in this room remember the 50s. This was the James Dean era, so I was driving a 51 Mercury with wearing leather jackets and motorcycle boots and carrying switchblade knives. And that's what I did at night. And yes, I did get in trouble. But the teacher said it couldn't have been him. True story, in court. The teachers came, including the principal, saying it couldn't have been him. He might have been there, but he must have been led by those other bad boys. Guess what? I was the leader. My compulsive eating began in earnest when I was 19 or 20 years old, and life got hard. My first real love that I had gone with all through high school, we went off to college together, and in my mind was this dream, this long-range dream, go to college, da-da-da-da-da, marry children down the line. My first real love broke my heart, shattered it, in fact, so badly that it shut me down emotionally for years. I can remember standing on top of a roof drunk, but I can still remember it, a dorm at the university, raising my fist to a God that I didn't believe in, saying, never again, never, ever again will I allow anybody in. And I resolved to never, ever need anyone. And thus a wall began to build around me. That wall of self-sufficiency was like a 20-year binge of self-sufficiency. That's really what it was about. Those were my bad years, the 20s and 30s, all about self-sufficiency, all about a wall built around me. So I dropped out of college. I went into the military to escape. I quickly met someone there and married her 6 months later. Classical rebound, I guess. It turned out to be a mismatch for me almost from the very beginning, a child marrying a child. In retrospect, I think from a maturity point of view, I was probably stuck somewhere in my mid-teens. I stayed in that marriage for 26 years, because where I came from, there was no such thing as divorce. My father once said to me, because I mentioned something about the marriage, and he said, no, 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 nobody ever gets a divorce. We don't do that in this culture. He didn't use the word culture. He just said, we don't do that in this area. It's never been the case. He said, just look at your mother and I. We've hated each other for years. But I stayed in the marriage. We had a child almost immediately. I was supposed to be a responsible adult, so I went back to school. I got an education, and I got a big job with a bunch of what eventually became a big job. In hindsight, I can see that I began emotionally overeating around this time, early 20s. In my early 20s, not consciously, but it's clear with hindsight, I can see that I began to use food as comfort, as escape, to take the edge off. In other words, I began using food as a drug, but not realizing, of course, what I was doing. It progressed. It took more and more to get the same effect. Two or three donuts became a dozen. A few cookies became the whole package. A couple of pieces became the whole cake. Half a pizza became a whole pizza. And gradually, it became almost continuous. Not just night binges after work, but I would eat on the way to work. I would eat while at work all day. I would eat on the way home from work. I would have dinner and then sit down in front of the TV and eat until midnight and go to bed drunk and get up next morning in a kind of a stupor, a food stupor that many of you in this room know about. At some point, obviously, I crossed an invisible line. I don't know exactly when. Maybe in my early 30s. But I graduated from a plain old emotional eater to the level of addict. Something happened to my mind and body, and I moved into a place where I no longer had any choices. I could not not eat. So sometimes I say I earned my way into addiction, the good old-fashioned way. Oh, yeah, the genetic predisposition was there. I've mentioned alcohol in my background. My mother was a compulsive overeater. Sugar was her thing, and at 92, it is still her thing. Today, she won't eat almost anything other than sugar. The genetic predisposition there, but I had to do my part. The more I ate, the more I wanted to eat. The first bite set up the urge for more and more and more and more and more and more. Sugar and refined carbs became to me what alcohol is to an alcoholic. I am addicted. I was addicted, body and soul. I couldn't stop. Could not stop, no matter how many resolutions and promises. No matter how many times I made resolutions to myself or promised my wife or promised anybody else, I couldn't do it. No matter how much it became evident that it was really, really starting to affect my career, I could not stop. Maybe early in my eating career I could have stopped. I don't know, maybe counseling, something like that. But I had passed that point. I was hooked. I was a prisoner of the disease. I was in bondage to it. And that's why I call myself a compulsive eater and a food addict. I distinguish a little bit of the difference there. I am clearly an addict, and I still have the propensity to use food as a drug in terms of for emotional reasons. Ultimately, the food took me to almost 400 pounds and all kinds of health problems that go along with that. Within a couple of years in OA, I was down nearly 200 pounds. For my top weight. I've been maintaining about 185 pound loss now for 27 years. I count my abstinence. I count my abstinence from June of 1984. Abstinence is 3 meals a day, nothing in between, no sugar, refined carbs. I weigh and measure more often than not when eating at home, but never out. 3 meals a day, nothing in between. Have I ever eaten too much at a meal over these 28 years? Sure. Not necessarily compulsively, though. Have I ever eaten between meals? No. Have not. Have you ever eaten sugar? Accidents happen. Dressing sometimes, on the road, whatever. I used to travel internationally. 2 weeks out of the month, I was out of the 2 weeks of the month for a long period of time. I was out of the country. Going to OA meetings, by the way, in other countries. But that was later on. But I have not had any intentional sugar. So sugar is clearly my alcohol. And staying away from that sugar and those refined carbs are the most important thing in my life, bar none. So at age 41, 1982, I found my way into that OA room that I was talking about 30 years ago next Thursday. Why was I there? Well, I didn't quite have the courage to kill myself. I was grossly obese. I was suicidal. And, of course, a hardcore, bitter atheist. Other than that, I had everything going for me. I argued in those first meetings, but really had no place else to go. So I finally surrendered to the suggestions of all these crazy people, and they were nuts. Surrender for me, though, wasn't giving up. It was deciding to cooperate. That was my surrender. It's important for me. Deciding to cooperate with a set of ideas and rules, physical, emotional, and spiritual, that I didn't invent. But other people said, your way didn't work, so let's do this other way. So I surrendered. I put down the food, I sobered up, and I dove into the rebuilding process of the 12 steps. Lo and behold, I discovered that Pogo was right. I have met the enemy, and it is me. I began to see, and not easily, but I began to gradually see that I fixed most of my problems by changing me, not my wife or anybody else, my boss, the president, whatever. I put down the food, I sobered up, and I dove into the rebuilding process of the 12 steps. Step by step, inch by inch, day by day, I began to change. Slowly, 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 my old thinking and my behaviors began to change. Hope crept in. That wall that I talked about, particularly in the fifth step, began to come down when I was honest with another person for the very, very first time in 42 years, as far as I knew, when I was totally honest with another human being. I began to understand what life was about. But, makes it sound that easy, doesn't it? I went along this road kicking and screaming and kicking and screaming. Thank God I had some tough love people around me, because that's what I needed. There was a guy named Charlie who carried a 2x4 around just so that he could bang me in the side of the head, metaphorically speaking. I asked Charlie for help in the early days. And this is what he told me it would take for me to get well. And was I really willing to do all this? And if I was, he would sponsor me. He said, you know, what it takes to get well, Don, is several things. Abstinence, abstaining from certain foods and food behaviors, like an alcoholic abstains from alcohol. It's impossible, he said, to get well from an addiction without abstaining totally. To get over overeating, you have to stop overeating. Second thing was hope. How do you feel? Can you get enough hope and expectations of better things to come? Where would I get that? And he said, listen carefully to people sharing what they were like and what they're like now. So my hope came from seeing others in the rooms before me that had done it. Remember the atheist. Courage, the courage to let go of my ideas and try another set of ideas. As I said before, my definition of surrender was not giving up, but deciding to cooperate. And so I had to drop the false pride, take off the mask of self-will and toughness and the I can do it myself attitude. That's what I had learned as a kid. Asking for help is weak. You just don't do that, particularly men. Honesty, he said, you need to get totally honest with yourself about everything in you and be honest with me. Was I willing to restructure my priorities and put first things first? Staying absent, that had to be the most important thing. Without it, I wouldn't get anywhere. A drunk cannot reflect on himself worth a damn. So you can't do the steps if you're drunk. Can you learn to discriminate, he says. Can you learn to avoid places and things and people that are not good for you? For now, for today, Nothing is forever. Taking actions, we don't get well. You don't get well, he said, by osmosis. I don't get well by just going to meetings any more than I become a parent by going to PTA meetings. I had to work the steps and take all of the dozens and dozens and dozens of actions that this requires. And lastly, he said, you got to accept the idea that you're going to fix most of your problems, Don, by changing yourself, not others. I didn't buy that one. But I decided to act as if I would comply with these crazy people. And I said, okay, I give up. I'll do it the best I can. I'll trust the process. And that was the time in those early days when that became important to me. And it's now 30 years later, and I still use it every day with some sponsee. You don't have to understand it. Just trust the process. It works. You don't have to understand how the steps work. Just do this for today, one at a time. This step, this question, write on this, do this. That's all you have to do. It was just like the addiction nonsense. I didn't believe I was an addict either. But he said, well, you don't really have to believe that. Just pretend that you are. And treat food accordingly. It wasn't until much later that it began to kind of seep into my brain that, you know, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, looks like a duck, might be a duck. So he said all this crap to me, and I said, man, are you kidding me? And he said, nope, that's it. And then he said something that didn't sound like it came out of his mouth. It didn't come from him. He said, extraordinary problems require extraordinary solutions. And I said, what does that mean? And he said something about willing to go to any length. He said, half measures don't even avail you half. Now, I didn't know what the big book was at that exact point. So he was quoting from the big book. It turns out this guy had 16 years sobriety in AA. And then he changed chairs on the Titanic and picked up the food. So I chose to play. Then there was the big book. They thrust the big book into my hand and told me to study it, that all the answers were in there. So I studied it, quickly read it. I mastered it in a short time, and I told my sponsor it was hopelessly outdated and sexist and needed to be rewritten. And I thought maybe I was just the guy to do it. And that's when the two befores began to come out. He said, you know, Don, I think one of your problems is you're educated beyond your intelligence. At first, I thought it was a compliment. And then it began to seep in. And that was the first time, and everybody's heard this, you know, take the cotton out of your ears, put it in your mouth, just shut up and follow the directions. Just do it. And that's basically what he kept telling me. Trust the process. Trust the process. Take the cotton out of your ears. Shut up. Quit arguing. A closed mouth gathers no foot. And I like that one a lot. I argued about the powerless. Here I was accomplished in the corporate world. Had enough money, had pretty good money, was doing a lot on that. And of course, only a few months before, I stood on that bridge wanting to kill myself, but I had all this other stuff. So I said, powerless? No, it can't be powerless. And he said, have you been able to stop? And I, of course, jumped on that one and said, oh, yes, many times. He says, have you been able to not start again? Well, you know. And I said, but it's all my wife's fault. He said, really? I said, yeah, I just eat what she fixes. He said, really? He said, how large is your wife? I said, what do you mean? He says, well, how tall is she? I said, well, maybe about 5'3". He says, how much does she weigh? I said, she's a pretty skinny lady. She approaches, I don't know, maybe 105, 110 pounds. He said, really? And you're how big now? You're almost 400 pounds. You're 6 foot tall. He said, do you mean to tell me that that little lady gets you down on the ground and takes that food and forces it into your mouth? Charlie had a way with words. I argued and argued and argued. He said, did you come here to get well or to argue? And I always thought that was a trick question. Because I couldn't quite figure out what the deal was. We got to the third step. Remember the atheist.
Got to the third step.
And I said, man, are you kidding me? And I was only working with AA 12 and 12 in the big book at that time. I said, are you kidding me? This is brainwashing. He says, well, maybe your brain is dirty and needs washing. One time later on, I said, I just can't do it. It's too much. It's too much. It's too much. He said, do you want your tombstone to read, he gave his almost. I was working the program, but for months, the suicide idea hadn't gone away. A couple of times I got discouraged and I said, I can't do this. I can't do this. My life is not going to change. I give up. It's too hard. I just want to go ahead and kill myself and do what I started. And he said, I'm sorry. Suicide is not a viable alternative for today. Maybe tomorrow. Let's see what we can do right now for today. We'll take tomorrow when it comes. And I would look at him and say, okay, and kept going. That was the beginning of learning truly what one day at a time means. Eventually, I began to see that to get well, I had to change how I ate, how I thought, and how I believed. I had to get rid of the food defects, the personality defects, and the spiritual defects. First, I had to put down the food. Once I put down the food, I began rebuilding myself through the 12 steps into who I was really meant to be in the first place. That work in the steps was what brought me the power to continue abstaining and eventually lifted the obsession as promised after step 9 in the big book. The steps, the tools, and the sponsor, my sponsor, the fellowship itself, were all powers greater than myself. My life, I believe, was then and still today, I believe, is a co-creation with God. I've been given the power to make decisions and to take actions. God will guide and give me strength, but he won't do for me what I need to do for myself. I'm in charge of actions. God's in charge of results. That's the way I look at it today. I heard somebody say, I won't take credit for this, but I like it. I'm the pilot. God is my navigator. I get to fly the plane. I am free to go wherever I want. But of course, everyone, including me, is probably better served if I follow the navigator's directions. And that's a little bit like I feel today. So the OA solution for me has been physical, emotional, and spiritual. Physically, it's about learning the nature of my food addiction and a new way of eating that keeps it in check. Emotionally, discovering the attitudes and beliefs and values that were counterproductive to living a good life. And spiritually, for me, it's been a journey within to meet my true self, to get in touch with that spirit within, which some people call God, and I do myself today, and to discover why I was given the gift of life in the first place. So my time is winding down. I just want to say a little bit about where the real action for me was in the steps 4 through 7. I mean, steps 1, 2, and 3, prepare me to get well. 4 through 9, get me well. 10, 11, and 12, keep me well. And so, in another time and setting, I would spend all my time talking about staying well, 10, 11, and 12. But I just want to say that where the action for me was, first identifying in 4 and 5 the key problems, the fear of what might happen, of conflict, of criticism, of looking bad, of failure, of not good enough, of being old, sick, poor, and alone. The phoniness, which is a subset of fear, perfectionism, I've talked about, mentioned in the workplace, false pride, too proud to show the real me or to open up, and controlling thinking, of course, the stage director in the big book, excessive concern about everyone's effect on me. One of the big things that I did was this mental master planning. I was always in my mind creating movies or scripts for how everything ought to go. What you should say, how you should react, what I should say, the scenario of everything. Now, the problem is, of course, you don't know the script. And so you don't do what I think in my head you should have done. I'm imposing shoulds and oughts on you. And I get pissed, and you don't even know why I'm mad. Because you can't read the script that's going on in my head. And even if you could, you wouldn't do it anyway. So who's the enemy? It's me. I have to give that up. So I identified those in 4, validated in 5. By the way, I just mentioned in 5, 5 was the beginning of my spiritual journey because, as I said before, it was the first time I'd really opened up to another human being. First time, 100% honest. And at the end of that 5th step, it took several hours for me. I had this really, really strange stuff going on inside of me. It was a little bit like as I was disclosing me, and the wall was beginning to come down, that there was suddenly room for maybe something to come in. And I haven't found any better word for that than the Christian word grace. And, you know, they say the hardest time for an atheist is when he's thankful and has no one to thank. And that's kind of like where I was. So in the 5th step, I began to open up. In 6 and 7, I worked on changing those things that I identified in step 4 and 5. Today, every morning, I still say the 7-step prayer, and at the end, I get very specifically, and I say specifically, God, would you help me to live in, and I have my own list, depending upon what's going on. I might say, help me to live in faith and trust today instead of fear and worry and self-sufficiency. Help me to live in a state of surrender rather than to trying to control and master life. Help me to live in a state of acceptance of the order of things and what is rather than anger and resentment. Help me to live with a positive and hopeful attitude rather than being negative and pessimistic. And so I still say that all the time. Step 10 for me every day is like weeding a garden. I might have done a good job in the first time through the steps, but weeds have a way of creeping back in. And so I have to look for those every day. My shortest version of my 11th step is find God, see what he wants me to do, and do it. The 11th step in the morning is the daily renewal of my faith. What I've found is that if I don't renew my subscription every morning, it runs out sometime during the afternoon. So my 11th step in the morning is very much a packing for the day and renewing my subscription. Step 12 is about passing it on. A lake to stay clear and clean needs a flow in and a flow out. My flow in is working the program. My flow out is passing it on. Passing on the program to others. And of course, living the principles. I just want to close by giving you some of my principles. I have a short list and a long list. I only have time for the short list. When I say practice these principles, what are these things for me? Acceptance of my disease and the will powerlessness over it. 2, committing myself to the 12 and 12 and 9 as a way to arrest my disease and keep it arrested. 3, the need to let go of trying to arrange and control things that are not controllable. 4, the need for ongoing inventory and correction of flaws as I go. The need to be absolutely honest with someone. 6, the need for forgiveness of self and others. 7, the need to clean up my past and my mistakes as I go. 8, the need for prayer and meditation and trying to keep myself aligned with God's purpose for me. 9, the need to try to help others who share my disease. And 10, a shift in attitude from self-centeredness to God-centeredness and other-centeredness. Thinking about what can I put in, not what can I give. Let me just say one last word on service. Two last words. One is, one of the best metaphors I think that I've ever, that has come out of my brain to describe myself, is that I feel like I was broken into many, many, many pieces when I came to OA. Surrendering to OA and taking the hundreds of actions that followed surrender, I think sort of welded me back together into a functioning and worthwhile human being. Those welds stay strong as long as I continue to live the 12-step way of life and stay in good spiritual condition. All that means daily action, daily action, daily action. I cannot coast. It's a little like going up and down escalator all the time. I have to keep moving, keep moving, keep growing, doing the daily routines every day. When somebody says, how in the world are you still around after 30 years? How in the world can that be? And that's what I say. I don't have a choice. I am an addict and a compulsive eater. I have a disease, and I have to deal with it. OA has saved my life. It has absolutely saved my life and allows me to continue to live and to function and to accept the world as it is. The world is not necessarily fair and just. It just is. The best line that ever came from my sponsor was, Don, expecting the world to treat you fairly because you're a good person is like expecting the bull not to attack you because you're a vegetarian. So get over it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don, for speaking.